Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Hillsborough author David Payne's epic new novel, Back to Wando Paso, a story of the Carolinas during the Civil War and the story of a modern-day Carolina family, has debuted to critical acclaim and more successful as in sales as well. And so David, who's visited with us before, has come back to report to us about his book tour. And of course, I'm very happy that this is done in conjunction with the broadcast this weekend on North Carolina Book Watch of the interview that we recorded some time ago, David. But welcome back to WCHL and Who's Talking.
Can't think of any place I'd rather be, D.G.
Well,
maybe a Caribbean island.
No, I think you'd probably like to be back in Hillsborough taking a long nap or because you've been busy these last few weeks, haven't you?
It's been a pretty hectic summer. I just got back from New England. I drove 3,100 miles in 11 days and went to 24 bookstores. So I'm a little bleary-eyed.
We're going to talk about your book, but can we talk about this tour just a little bit, the mechanics of it? What's fun for me as I talk to authors is that the book tour, in many respects, is kind of like the tour of Europe that a young teenager has in mind. And then when you get on it, you just say, oh, my golly, it's just, it's tiresome and work and all of this. Did you have fun on your tour this time?
I did. I'm going mostly to independent bookstores, places like Quail Ridge and Raleigh, the Regulator, except up north. And every place I go, I meet these really interesting folks who I think the independent booksellers, I have so much respect and regard for them because they are the ones who are really looking at the books that come out, choosing the little gems that you've never heard of, and putting a lot of effort and energy behind them. And if it weren't for them, everything would be presented to us through the corporate model, which just picks out a few, and it's that or nothing. So they're the ones that are keeping alive, I think, real reading in this country in a way that is really important.
So the discussion, if nothing else, the discussion with the owners or the managers and salespeople in these bookstores give you a lift.
Gives you a big lift. And the other part of it is that the way that books like mine, I think, and others tend to find their way to readers is through hand selling. When you go into a bookstore, there's that one person who, let's say, they tell you to read such and such, and you go home and it's fabulous, and you come back, and after a while, you develop a relationship with that person, and when what they tell you to read, you read, and that is the life of independent bookselling. So to get those folks behind you is a big...
How do you do that when you come in? Let's say particularly, they know you're coming, so some of them may have had the chance to read your book, but...
Very few.
In
New England.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Whereas I'm coming from a book that's, a bestseller in the South, and finding when I went to New England, with the exception of some people who were friends and longtime supporters, very few people had read it. But by the time I left, more and more are starting to read it. And I think that's where a lot of the reorders are coming from in the last couple of weeks.
Well, now, how did you this kind of cart before the horse, because
yeah.
We need to know a little bit about the book to know why I would be skeptical about people in New England getting engaged in this book, because it is a very Southern, maybe Gothic in the right term to use, but I mean it is wrapped up in the South, and the appeal. I'm curious about what you found the appeal in among New England people to be.
The book is Southern, as Annie Dillard said, down to the molecular level. I mean, there's no question. The setting is Southern. The style is Southern. It's got that sort of lyrical, expansive technique, However, I think that the characters are, even though their backgrounds are Southern, they're people that you could meet anywhere. They're people that are worldly. They've had a wide experience of life. They've lived in New York City. They've traveled. The issues that they're dealing with in their marriages and outside their marriages are the same things that people in Boston are dealing with, the same people that people in San Francisco are dealing with. So I think it's the characters that are at the heart of the interest that people in other regions.
Well, that's interesting. So when I talk about your book among people here in the South, I tend to go to setting, that this is set on a South Carolina low country plantation, and that there's this North Carolina redneck who has been a rock star who comes and interacts, and it's all Carolinas and setting. When you're, this is a question, when you're, it sounds like a sermon, but when you're talking to a New England bookseller, then you would not point it in that direction, but talk this complex relationship between a rock, you know, a person who's been in New York and part of the music scene, and his marriage is crumbling because of his mental illness and can't get used to not being a star. And these are you talk about relationships, sort of. Is that or what do you say?
Well, I do think that marriage is a big piece of this book. I mean, it has, of course, it has the Civil War, it has the voodoo supernatural element, it has rock and roll, as you said. But at the heart of it, it's a story about two marriages, one in the Civil War era and one in the modern era. And both of them are facing the same dilemma, which I think is perhaps not all that uncommon. That is, you have, in the case of the modern marriage between Ransom Hill, the main character, and his wife Claire, you have a 19-year-old marriage that's road-worn. It's they've been through a lot of ups and a lot of downs. They have separated. They have come back together. They have had children. They've done the better, the worse, the sickness and health, richer and poorer. But here, at a certain moment in time, the wife experiences an attraction outside the marriage. And as she says at one point in the book, it's like, I'm like a green plant that must turn to the sun. And the sun is this new relationship. So what is the answer to that dilemma when you have your vows, you have a long-term marriage, you have a commitment, and things have deteriorated and become sort of tired within the marriage, and then suddenly this explosive, incandescent new thing enters your life? I find that an interesting moral dilemma. On the one hand, you've made that vow, you know, for better and for worse. On the other hand, it's almost as if some kind of higher power is putting this new thing into your life. And the question I think she asks is, am I turning away from my own highest capacity to be human, to be good, to live the fullest possible life by turning away from this powerful new love that's entered my life? So you have that kind of situation that I think is almost anyone who, above a certain age, who's ever been married, whether or not the affair thing has been part of it, people know what it's like to be in a long-term relationship and to have gone through those ups and downs. And I think that is something that transcends the regional quality and that people can identify with.
Well, gosh, I hate to get away from the story, but let me ask you this question about New England. What kind were the questions that you got as you either read or visited with the staffs of the bookstores? The questions that they raised with you, were they similar, the same as those that you got in this region, or did you find that you could tell this is a question from New England and this is a question from Chapel Hill?
I do think that there is among the Northeastern literary establishment, there is a tendency to describe a book like this as, you actually used this word, but as gothic.
Right. An unfortunate term.
No, it's okay. I mean, I've never fully known exactly what that means. I mean, we all sort of know what it means. We know Flannery O'Connor, and we know we know others.
It's when the moss is dripping. I don't know.
Right.
I mean, I don't know.
Well, the moss is dripping in this book to a degree.
And so, there are supernatural things happening.
Well, that is a very interesting thing for me. I don't know how interesting it is to others, but the way this book evolved, it's two stories, first of all. There's, as you said, the present day and the past story. And the way I see them, the way that they came to me in the writing, I started the present day story first, and I wrote quite a bit of that before I got involved in the past story. And the way I thought this book would work is something like that they would both be essentially realistic stories, that the past story would be essentially just like the present day story, except that it's set in an earlier era. But as I began the writing, certain things began to creep into the past story that do not really appear in the present day story. You have, for instance...
Let me just say,
go ahead.
We need to take a break.
Okay.
And I really would, if we can take a quick break, then come right back and go right into that past story. And I'll try not to interrupt you, and we'll just keep going. I'm talking to David Payne about both his brand new novel, Back to Wando Paso, and the experience that he's had on the road visiting with bookstores all over the country to talk about the book. Ken, I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. David Payne and I are talking about his new novel, Back to Wando Paso. It's got two stories in it. He shared with us some of the bare bones of the modern day story. And I think you're ready to tell me about the, what do we call it, the old story?
The past story,
past
right.
Story.
Well, the past story, the center of it is about and it starts in 1861, May of 1861, a month after the firing on Fort Sumter. You have a 33-year-old spinster, she would have been regarded as a spinster back in those days, who has made a marriage of convenience to the owner of the plantation. And she's traveling up the river, up the Petee River in South Carolina, to join her husband at Wando Paso, which is the plantation where it's all set. But as I was saying earlier, as I got to work on the story, certain elements crept into the past story that really weren't in the present story. For instance, the man that Addie, the past heroine, marries is his name is Harlan, and he's the future master of Wando Paso. He has served an apprenticeship in Cuba on a sugar plantation. His family owns properties both in South Carolina and sugar plantations in Matanzas province in Cuba. And while he's there, he meets a woman and falls in love with her. She is a woman of mixed race, and he falls in love with her without really knowing who she is. And it turns out later that she's related to him, and he has no way of knowing this. So what I was trying to get to is that there's an element of brother-sister incest, as you had, you know, in the Byron Augusta Lee story. There are, you know, there's this voodoo element. There are things that are almost like folk tales or fairy tale that have almost an otherworldly quality. And I think if you sat down and analyze the present day story, you would not find that the same things occurring in both. So to me, the book took a little bit of it has a little bit of the quality of, there are really two parts of us as human beings, as I see it. We wake up in the morning, the sun is shining, we get up, we're awake, we put our pants on, we go out, we live in a world where cause follows effect in a logical and orderly sequence. Well, then we go home, and at night we fall asleep, and we enter a world where things proceed according to a different logic, not simple cause and effect, but it's a symbolic logic of that we see in dreams, we see it in folk tales, we see it in fairy tales, we see it in those old stories. And somehow the past story of Wando Paso almost demanded to me to be written in a little bit more of that way. And I think that's where some of the, you know, the father who has the two sons that he has to choose between.
You have to explain that.
Well, Harlan DeLay, who I was just talking about, his father, the owner of Wando Paso, who is about to die as the story begins, has a white son, Harlan, who is set to inherit the plantation, and he has a son by a black Cuban mistress and slave who is the steward and the caretaker of the plantation, whom he is temperamentally closer to. They enjoy conversation and discussing poetry and literature, and they're much closer. But because of the racial difference, the second son, Jerry, is not going to inherit what the white son will inherit. So that's another of those elements that to me is a little bit like a folk tale or a fairy tale.
That helps me a lot in terms of that, what, again, putting words in your mouth, that in the past, looking at the past story, while it's set in reality and based on an incredible amount of research, that there is a little bit of suspension of belief that you urge, that you might encourage your readers, because it's past and there's a folktale quality that complements the present story. I don't want to say it's not real, but I'm just saying that it's easier if you say, relax.
It's bigger and it's a little more heightened than the present day story. And what I was starting out by saying is that I did not set out to write it that way. I thought the both stories, the present and the past, would follow the same essential
storylines, just, and these would be parallel stories set in the different
just
times.
Just in two different times. But the...
broke away from you.
It wrote itself in that way. And whenever I tried to force the past story into a more realistic model, it would fizzle out. Whenever I let it go into that sort of bigger, more heightened place, it would take off. And so ultimately I had to say, it's telling me where it wants to go, and I just have to write it that way. So I did.
One of the things that authors often find as they go about the country talking about their books, and you can't do that. When you become the expert on something, I mean, the great thing is that you know more than 99.9% of the people about various matters, but there's always this 0.1% that pop up and tell you things you didn't know that might have been important to you, or at least interesting to you as you were writing the book. And they sometimes pop up on these book tours. I wonder, have you learned some things you didn't know from people, or have you found that you are the expert on these things?
I absolutely am not the expert. I am a rank beginner in many of the things that I wrote about. However, for instance, let's take the voodoo element. As I think I told you the last time we talked, I stumbled on a reference to this particular school of voodoo in a book. It was the first time I encountered it, and it was about a man who had gone down to this is a real village in South Carolina called Oyatunji. It's not too far from Beaufort.
I'm interested in this, but as I've talked about your book, that a lot of people know about this village. In fact, when I start talking about your book and the mixture of Cuban, African, I always say voodoo-like, because you cautioned me that it wasn't really voodoo. They know about this village. This is kind of
famous.
Come into the consciousness,
yeah,
the national
well.
Consciousness. But you went deeper into this.
Well, I discovered, first of all, that village, I mean, to get really technical, they follow customs that come from the Yoruba, and that's a West African tribe, which is in the... But there was a woman there named, I don't remember her name actually, but she had one of these black iron pots, these prendas, which is the artifact that I use in the book, which comes out of a Cuban school of called Palo Mayombe. And when I first stumbled on this and tried to find out about it, there was virtually nothing written on it in English. So I had to go back to the Spanish sources and pick my way through as a non-Spanish speaker or reader. First of all, Palo Mayombe is now all over the U.S. It's been brought over with the Cuban immigrant community. It's in Miami, Jersey, Philly.
Now, just to get me straight, this is Cuban, but now where are its origins in Africa?
The Congo region.
And that's different from this village in South Carolina
The ancestry of the customs in Oyatunji, you would trace them up to Benin around that area in West Africa, whereas the Congo is, I don't know, 800 to 1,000 miles south of there.
And so the importation of Africans into Cuba came from the Congo, the importation of African slaves to the South Carolina coast, and this near this village came from Benin and the northern. Maybe it's getting too complicated.
Put it this way: 40%. From my understanding, 40% of the slaves who came into New Orleans and Charleston came out of the Congo region. There was a large contingent of Congo slaves. Now, slaves from the Congo went all over the Americas in the Caribbean, and they took their religious and magical traditions with them, and wherever they went, they turned into... They kept certain similarities, but they morphed into different things. In Brazil, it turned into something called Umbanda. In Jamaica, it turned into Obia. In Cuba, it turned into Palomayombe. In here, in the United States, it turned into what was called conjure in the 19th century, so a conjure woman, a conjure man. And now it's more typically known as hoodoo. The Palomayombe, the Cuban school that I dealt with, the central practice is they take these black iron pots, they put various things in them, sand from the seashore, dirt from beneath the jail, the courthouse, the graveyard. They put insect and animal remains in them. Ultimately, they will go out to the graveyard and they knock on the graves of departed ancestors, and they say that they will be answered. With a knock or whatever it may be, some sign will occur that this person has consented to become the spirit within that person's pot. So they will dig up that person's bones, put them in the pot, make sacrifices to it, and then they say that that person becomes the spirit ally of the owner of the pot, and that person can send the spirit out into the human world to do his bidding for good or ill.
Now, I want to ask you about how that idea worked its way into your book, but we're going to take a quick break first. I'm talking to David Payne about his new novel, Back to Wando Paso. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with David Payne about Back to Wando Paso, his new novel. We're talking about the book and about the book tour, about the success of the novel. And we're talking about this black pot that comes from, I guess just to simplify it, it comes from African religious traditions that have been brought to the Americas with the importation of slaves. And you've described... How that black pot works, sort of, or what? Now you found out about this. So here's the question: Did your interest in the black pot drive the black pot into the story, or did the story need the black pot and you went out looking for it and found it, or needed something and found the black pot?
I think it was a little bit of both. One thing that I knew early on in the writing of this book was that I was going to need magic of some sort, because I had these two stories, as we've talked about, and my idea from the very beginning was that these stories were in each the past and the present, you have a love triangle. You know, we've talked about that. And my notion was that those triangles were sort of congruent in a certain way, and that what happened in the past, partway through the book, two skeletons turn up on the plantation that have been buried in shallow graves, and we suspect that they've been there for 140 years. So we know that that past triangle ended in a murder. We don't know who murdered whom, but we know it ended in a murder. And we have this black pot that has been unearthed on the plantation, and it appears that it is exerting some kind of force or influence that is causing the present to follow the same trajectory as the past followed. So the question is the love triangle in the present day going to lead to a murder as well, and is the pot causing that to happen? So my idea was that these two plot lines were like they were converging toward a climactic moment when the past and the present would collide like the atom come together in a sort of moment of nuclear fission, and past and present would blend together. All the characters from all the different plot lines would sort of join in a single moment, and the plot would be resolved and answer that question, which I think in some ways is the central question of the book, and that is, are we doomed to repeat the tragedies of the past, or is it possible to break the cycle, of the past? Are we doomed, to repeat the over and over again the same destructive cycles, or can we break them?
Well, this part of the plot presents a challenge for the story writer, who's dealing with a literate audience primarily in the United States, but all over the world, who do not believe in magic. And magic becomes, magic is not the right word, in the religion and the supernatural powers that operate in the book. And so you have to understand that there is a moment of disbelief that the reader might encounter at this really at the important climactic moments. And so how do you just ask your reader, think of this as a fairy tale, or do you say, be careful not believing this because these things might happen? I mean, what in your mind as you're thinking about your reader dealing with this?
Well, the way I dealt with that was by writing it so that it would read in one of two different ways. One is that there is, in fact, a supernatural momentum at work that is causing this things to operate in this way. The second is that Ransom Hill, the protagonist of the book, is manic depressive, and it may be that all of this is simple, has a psychological explanation, and so the reader really gets to make his or her choice about how they interpret what's going on. Is this, in fact, a supernatural occurrence, or is it a psychological occurrence? And both answers are possible, or it may be, again, some combination of the two.
And how are your readers? As you visit, I guess most of the people haven't finished the book yet. Some are coming in ready to grab you and talk to you about all kinds of things. But for those for that kind of reader who has read it and has all these questions, what kind of questions do you get about that aspect of it, about the magic-like aspect?
Well,
of it?
I've had people say things to me like, is this really true? Is this real? Did you make up all this stuff about Palamayombe and spirits in pots and, or did you, did that come from something real? And I have to say to them, no, this, I'm not personally advocating it, but it is something that I researched. It is something that many people believe in. And frankly, I have to say that after studying it, speaking to practitioners of it, looking into it for 5 years, the idea that there is something going on that we don't understand. And I think we all know deep down inside that, for instance, voodoo. I mean, we know that that's not just, people making up. I think most people know that. Know that it's not simply making up something out of whole cloth that has no basis in reality whatsoever. If you get close to it, and if you encounter it as closely as I have, it's hard to say whether the claims are exactly as the practitioners make them, but that there is something going on. It's almost impossible for me to deny that there's something going on.
It raises an interest. I mean, your book and the discussion raises real dilemma, I think, for believers in the Christian or Judeo-Christian religions or the Islamic, the sort of monotheistic religions, because you're torn in two directions. One is to have great respect for believers of any sort who believe sincerely in their religious practices, knowing deep down inside that your own beliefs are grounded on matters that people are skeptical of this kind of laugh at behind your back, that because they're based on supernatural type bedrock. Then, so a mutual respect of all believers who have supernatural foundations. And then on the other side of it, that many of these religious beliefs, including mine, say these practices are forbidden and they come from the devil, and you just can't, you know, they're to be shunned and put aside.
Right.
Now, you must have had to wrestle with some of this.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I think the most important thing I can say that I learned about all of these traditional African practices is that our understanding of them in the West is very distorted. When we think that they're about putting curses and doing evil deeds and dark things in the dark of night, but basically these religions are serious world religions that offer aid, comfort, spiritual guidance to the vast majority of their practitioners, that offer solace in the same way that Christianity does, and that most of the people who practice them are practicing them for moral reasons. That is, to become better human beings, to get into a better relationship with the divine energies as they understand them to be. And it's the rare exception where someone is using it for a malignant purpose.
Well, but in your book, the pot's usefulness does become aimed at, it does become a weapon in the hands of people that is not totally, not totally something that is friendly and
it does become a weapon, but and it is misused in this book. However, the reason this pot is constituted in the first instance is because justice has been denied the slaves on this plantation. The woman who makes this pot, who creates it, is seeking justice. And that is why the pot is created. And she, even though it's, I think what we would regard, she's not a nice person. She's a tough customer. She is angry about what's been done to her. But at the same time, what she's asking for is justice. Mm-hmm. And the pot is originally
justice in her view.
That's right.
Well, we need to take a break. I'm talking to David Payne about his novel, Back to Wando Paso, and the magic-like, voodoo-like features of the novel, which enrich it and create the complexities that we're talking about today. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. David Payne from Hillsboro is the author of Back to Wando Paso, a recently released novel, and he's just back from a long travels promoting the book. David, give us a report on how the book is doing.
Well, it's been on the SIBA, that's the Southern Independent Bookseller's bestseller list, since early June, and it's gone back to press twice in the last 9 days. So that's I'm pretty pleased about that.
Going back to press means that there are not enough copies in the warehouse to satisfy the demand that the readers are creating. And
correct.
That's a good news for an author, I guess.
Yes.
Well, that's terrific. Do you feel that your travels and that the contacts that you've had in bookstores across the country have had that much of an impact on the sales of the book? Can you?
DG, it's very hard to know. I was thinking about this morning, that being in the midst of a publication is like being, let's say, an infantry soldier in the middle of a battle that's occurring across a vast front that's 10 miles wide. Or maybe it's like being, a tank driver, and all I can see is the walls of the tank, and I can see the viewfinder. But what's going on in the battle as a whole, you don't know. You're sort of at
the
mercy.
The reports that you're winning, but you've got a narrow range of. Well, it must be fun to both participate on it at the foot soldier level, and then also to hear good optimistic reports from the national battlefield.
It is, and it's quite a roller coaster, because one day something great will happen, and the next day, you'll think the world is ending, and then nothing will happen, and then something else happens. So,
well, in the end, these spikes, I guess, of activity for an author, which involve the release of the book, and then a lot of sales and promotion activity from the publisher and from yourself, and then after a while, it either settles into being a classic on the backlist, which with regular sales, or it kind of fades away, and you have to think of something else. Is it easy to move from this time of excitement and attention to your book towards a time when you have to go back to work on another one?
I think that there is something about the process of doing all this traveling and promotion and talking about the book ceaselessly and thinking about it day and night that wears you out and makes you ready to turn to something else, no matter what it is, just to get away from it finally and say, okay, I got out, I hustled for it, I did my best, but I'm sick to death of it and ready to roll and move on to something new. And so it's like many things in life that it has its own rhythm and it comes to a natural end, and then your attention moves to the next thing.
What kinds of things are you interested enough in now to think that you might be willing to spend another several years, as you tend to do, on another project that would involve both the kind of research that you do and also the story creation aspects of it?
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I'm thinking of, and don't hold me to this because I, 2 weeks from now I may say something different, but I'm thinking of possibly doing a shorter nonfiction project my next time out. And I've written about it fictionally several times, but and as I said earlier, my main character in this book is manic depressive. But I may have said to you the last time that we met that I had a brother who was manic depressive. And so there's been a history of it in my family. My brother died tragically in an auto accident in 2000. And just left a tremendous hole in my life and in my family's life. And I think, I don't know, I talk to so many people. You sit down with people in a bar or over dinner, and when the gloves come off and the hair gets let down, you hear so often about that one person in the family, and that somehow it's as though there's one person in every family or in many families that's carrying the bag for all the rest. And this was so much my brother's role. I mean, he was smart, he was good looking, he was talented, and this disease just undermined him, for 30 years, and he fought like a champion against it. And I'm thinking that that maybe that's what I'm going to write about.
Well, there's a preview of that in your lead character in this book, Ranson, who's you're talking about the family tragedy aspect of it, or human tragedy aspect of it, but that Ranson typical is not the right word, but so often you see the manic depressive person as being, just a bundle of energy and creative juices, so much more superior to many other people in their ability to get jobs done, to be creative, come up with ideas, and that it's a association with a wonderful trait with kind of a tragic trait, and wrestling with all this, as you did in this book, it's a challenge. So I will welcome the possibility that you might shed some new light on this.
Well, the research that I've done, many, many famous people, from Churchill to possibly Lincoln, Kurt Cobain. There's something about the manic side of it that gives these people an unusual level of energy that allows them to do almost superhuman things. But then, of course, there's the dark downside of it.
Almost Faustian in the sense. Well, anyway, golly, you got me thinking, and I, as you work on this project, maybe we can persuade you to come back and talk about the development of your thoughts, whether it leads to a book or just more wisdom. And thanks for the wisdom you shared in this book and the great story in Back to Wando Paso. If you're listening to this and haven't taken a look at it, this is perhaps a book that's going to be a classic. Thanks, David Payne.
Thank you so much, DG.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.